That, some of you will immediately be disappointed because I think there's many factors, reasons for maybe why some of you might be disappointed to hear that ethics is going to be coming up. And one of them is, I think, is in the West, we have a lot of ideas of shoulds around ethics. And ethics can be somewhat oppressive because of all the shoulds that we sometimes are struggling with or struggling to be free of. The there are two ethical areas which are usually laid out as the foundation upon which a person does mindfulness practice, and one of them is dana, which usually translates into English as generosity, and the other is the precepts. So mostly I want to talk about precepts, perceptual ethics, this evening, but I also want to take the opportunity to talk a little bit about dana. Because in relationship to what we do here, I'm often fairly reluctant to talk about the dana system. I'm a little bit shy about it. And so I think more than any other teacher that I know, I tend to kind of ignore it, not say anything. And other teachers kind of chide me and say, you know, you have to, it's your responsibility. You have to talk about it more. And so I thought I would just, rather than mumble a few words, kind of get it over with, I would just try to address it more wholeheartedly here. Addressing things wholeheartedly is more of the practice anyway. And so the way that the teaching happens in the tradition that we're in is done in the spirit of dana, which is translated usually as generosity, but it might not be the best translation. Sometimes you translate it as donation. And I don't think donation is even the right word. I think just keep the word dana because of the implications it has. But in part, what the dana system is about is dana is about supporting others so as to allow, in a strict sense, in a stricter sense of the word dana, to allow the dharma, to allow the practice to flourish, to unfold. And so there's the dana of the dharma itself. There's a dana of the teaching, dana of the practice. And in part, that's my role at these meetings here, is that I'm imparting the dana, the of some kind of teaching. I hope it's good teaching, and that, and I see very much my role in our gathering here on Monday evenings, and the role of the gathering itself is to support all of us in our mindfulness practice, to kind of support it, encourage it, inform it. So that it's easier for us to negotiate the path on our own, so that we can support our own practice. So that's what I see my role as being, supporting you all, and also to some degree my own practice, because it's difficult to do it on our own. So there's dawn in that direction. There's also dawn in the direction of the teacher, or the teaching, or the in Asia sometimes institutions, because they have big institutions or small ones. And sometimes in the West we think that it's exchange. We have very much the exchange model, that what we're doing is we're exchanging, that the teacher is giving you something and you're going to give something back. And so you calculate, well, if I go to a therapist, that's how much it costs there, and so maybe it's kind of comparable. Or if I go to, a movie, and I'll pay $7 for a movie, and, and this is about the same number of minutes, and I don't know how you calculate, but it's a calculation of kind of exchange model. And I suppose that's fine to do it that way. But I think there's another whole aspect to what's happening with dana, especially in the direction of a teacher, supporting or allowing a teacher to do all the things that a teacher does. And a teacher does a lot more than come in front and give dharma talks. So if you're only relating to a teacher, the teacher gives dharma talks, he gives a talk, and that's it. That's fine. I mean, you're not being asked to think anything more than that. However, in the bigger picture of the dharma of Buddhism or of kind of a wider sangha of activities, a teacher is involved in a lot of activities that supports this happening, but also supports a lot of other people to practice. And a lot of what a teacher does is like, for, I don't know, just myself, I spend a lot of time on the phone. I talk to a lot of people who are complete strangers. And for some reason, they get my phone number and, you know, and they're having a spiritual crisis. And so I feel like I have to respond. And there's phone calls about planning. There's meeting people. There's invitations to teach in situations where there is no Dana. So I often do that. For example, up at Stanford, I teach at Stanford for the students there. And I've never, it just doesn't seem appropriate there to ask them or to put out a basket. It just, I just do it because students don't have much money. And there's many situations like that, a lot of activity that goes on. There's a certain amount of study that has to happen. There's my own practice that has to happen. And it turns out, I was trying to think today, you know, how many hours a week I spend doing things that are related to being a teacher. And at some point I wanted to stop counting the hours because I didn't want to believe it. But, you know, it's like it's getting to be close to a full-time job. There's easily weeks I spend more than 40 hours a week, easily, on kind of just all the dharmic affairs that I take care of. And so there's that whole aspect of that dana in part is supporting the dharma or supporting the teacher or whatever to allow the whole show to happen. And so when people give dana, it's not so much an exchange, I believe, but people the idea is for people to give freely. And this is what they want to do. They feel inspired to give. They're not being asked to give. And very strong feelings, we really want to offer the teachings freely for two reasons. One is that it's considered, the teachings are considered priceless, and so you can't put a price on it. And the other reason is that to make it as accessible to people as possible so that as many people can come, and many of us who practice in Asia are so grateful that it was offered to us so free. And if I added up all the hours, all the days that I sat on retreat in Asia for free, and figure and multiply it by the amount it costs per day to sit on a retreat in America. Say it costs $40 a day in America to go on a retreat, just for the cost of the retreat. And I add up all the days that I was on a retreat in Asia, I'd still be paying my debts. And, you know, it's just, I couldn't have done everything except for that it was given freely. So it's kind of, we want to give, I think many of us teachers want to give it back freely because it was given to us freely. And also to make it accessible to a wide range of people. And so in that system, there are some people then who will give, you know, will give very little. But it's as much as they can. It's like what they feel that's in their means. And some people who are very wealthy who give much more. That's kind of what they feel they can give. And so the whole range. And it doesn't really matter what the amount is. I think what matters is the intention and an understanding behind it. And in a very real sense, this practice and Buddhism—you don't necessarily have to relate them as being the same—but wouldn't take root in the West in America, they wouldn't unless the teachers were supported. So you should know that, and not just the teachers, but also the sangha, also the community of people, and like a spirit rock, it's building a whole meditation center and making donations to build a whole center. And it's an awkward system in the West because we don't understand it. And it's awkward for the teachers, it's awkward for the students, it's awkward for everyone. And but this is what we're struggling with, at least for the time being. We're trying to make this work. The alternative is to charge, or there are many alternatives. And I think most of us are reluctant to take that step. And even though there's these stories you hear of how places where they started charging, like there's a fellow I met from Australia who teaches Vipassana in Australia, and he did the Dana system for a long time, and he could barely kind of get, you know, pay his bills at the end of the month and get through. And then he switched to charging a fee. And within, I don't know, a year or something, he was teaching something like 14 introductory courses a week. And, you know, there's tons of people. He had got a whole big center and building and everything. And what does that say about our culture? That a thing will flourish if you charge for it, but not if it's free. It's kind of, I think the TM people kind of understood this. And maybe there's some wisdom to what they did. That in this culture we're here, money is what, we respect things through money. So the more expensive it is, the more you respect it. So that's my kind of putting it all out there. Do you have any questions about that or comments? Yes.
I just wanted to say that I'm not sure even if you have, you know, more numbers of people, I'm not sure that you can still keep the quality. It may draw more people, but I'm not sure that there is still sincerity. We might have more bodies, but I'm not sure. I don't know if I'm saying it right. I mean, in a way, I think in this culture it does draw more people because people value the dollar. Mm-hmm. But you might have mobs of people, but it might not have the authenticity or the sincerity that you have in a smaller group.
Oh, I agree.
That would be a worrisome.
Oh, yeah. I worry about that too. So maybe that's a good reason to make it cheap. So that the real value is kind of hidden from public eye. Yes?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think a major part of the teachings you do is the example you lead. And by leading an example this way, that not all value is measured by dollars. I think this is a good example to set in this culture because it's seen so seldom. Mm-hmm. And I happen to think it's a good one.
Uh-huh.
And if you started charging, that would wipe that out completely.
Yeah.
Immediately.
There's also a beautiful part about, I don't know if modeling is the right word here, but maybe modeling a level of trust. That part of my life, what it's become is that even before I was a teacher, but I've kind of entrusted my life to the Dharma, whatever the Dharma is. And every time I've done that, it seems like I'm taken care of by the Dharma. So it's this level of trust that it'll be fine, and that's kind of how I live my life in some ways. And so far, it's been fine.
And the reciprocal is it does put responsibility on each person to be trustworthy and to decide rather than to obey. You have to decide.
And it's easy to kind of just stumble in here periodically, but I think when you kind of at some point when you understand what's going on. I think it also requires you to kind of reflect deeper on what you're doing and what your intention is and what your relationship is than it would be if you're just paying a certain amount. Because then it's not quite as casual as stumbling in, but then it's a lot that's just taken for granted. Yes?
There's a psychological term we learned in school called cognitive dissonance, and it means that you value more than you paid for, so that whether or not you paid the same thing for Lancome as for Maybelline, it doesn't matter how good they are, you can value the more expensive one more. And people who were given no pay at all to do certain work had to find their own value in the work that was being done.
Uh-huh.
People that were given some pay, the same work found no value in what was being done except the pay. So for us to come here every week, and not pay for it doesn't fit into the cognitive dissonance mold.
Uh-huh.
we're not being paid. We haven't paid, so therefore we don't have to come. Not paying means that we can't value what we're getting on the basis of what we paid for it. And it blows your mind out of that model of cognitive dissonance.
Oh, great. I hope your minds are all blown. So the last comment on Donna, then we'll move on. Yeah.
I have a friend, a teacher, who said, I don't think you've ever heard the Tibetan mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And it's kind of a joke. It's kind of like, you know, may there be wealth, may there be bounty.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that Donna is a practice, you know, it is a parami. It's something that you can perfect. There's a perfection in the free. And the more that there is a freeing in a given, the more energy there is, and it's like a boundless energy. It can be a chinrezi kind of
beautiful,
you know, like a loving kindness kind of boundless thing. But you do have to find that value, that you know, that And you can make it a practice too, not just with money, but you know. I had a friend who used to practice like giving 6 gifts a day, consciously,
uh-huh.
You know, because you are giving. It's just becoming conscious of
beautiful.
The exchange, how you give and receive. And
beautiful,
and
beautiful.
And
there's a lot of other forms of dana besides money, for sure.
Exactly.
And part and also in terms in relationship to this main subject right now is teacher rather than dana in general. But there's other things that is useful for a teacher besides money. And one of them is feedback.
Hmm.
I think that's kind of a dana also, and I think that's also a useful part of the whole opening up. But I think dana is, as you said, dana sometimes is understood as is an expression of open-heartedness and non-clinging, and it goes out to everything. It's certainly not just to the people you meet on the street and friends and. Okay, so that's the first foundation, and the classic path of Theravada and Buddhism starts with a discussion of dana, and we could talk a lot more about it. And then the next level, as usually talked about, is ethics. And ethics in Buddhism is probably for many of you is very different from Judeo-Christian or Western ideas of ethics or of morality, and especially in that. In Buddhism, there is no deity who's ordaining this is right or wrong, or there's good or bad, or this is sinful or not sinful. That Buddhist criteria for ethics is much more pragmatic and conditional and situational. There is no divinely ordained ethics in Buddhism. Ethics in Buddhism is somewhat forward-directed, kind of future-directed, in the sense that it looks at two things. It looks at the intention behind the action. And intention is very important. The shape and the characteristics of the intention of what you do. Is it characterized by aversion or hate or pushing away? Or is it characterized by clinging or holding on or greed? And understanding that. And then understanding what the consequences are of the action. The consequences of greed or the consequences of hate just for oneself. And of those actions that are motivated by that in the world around us. And then, correspondingly, what are the consequences of living a virtuous life, of living a life that doesn't kill, that respects life? What are those consequences? Understanding the consequences of what the actions are is part of what feeds the way in which we measure our activity. So rather than good and bad, or evil, or right or wrong, the technical words that they use, the kind of duality that's used in Buddhism, is wholesome and unwholesome, or sometimes translated as skillful and unskillful action. So you don't say something's good or bad, you say, well, that was skillful, or that was unskillful. That was wholesome, that was unwholesome. So you don't put this kind of absolute criteria on it. But the way it's labeled is according to, in some sense, what the consequences are. An unwholesome or unskillful act is going to have unskillful results. It's obvious that there's such things. If you rob a bank, that's going to have certain kind of negative results. And if you do a generous act, that has kind of positive results. So that's kind of a little bit So Buddhism has traditionally these five precepts. It's called the five great precepts or the five lay precepts. It's mostly for lay people, but it's a foundation of precepts, and the precepts of the monastics, they have 227, is based, it's kind of the foundation of them is these five that are used for everyone, for lay people. And these are not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to misuse sexuality, and not to indulge in intoxicants. And that's kind of the basic precepts. And there's sometimes these precepts are called the treasures of Buddhism, the treasure of Buddhism. Sometimes it's called the blood vein of Buddhism. And blood vein means that it's, you know, this is the circulation of Buddhism. What keeps it alive is the precepts. What nourishes it. In looking at the precepts or thinking about ethics, there are three ways, there are many ways, but I want to talk about three ways you can understand ethics in certainly in Buddhist context, but maybe in any context. And there's three levels or layers or categories. And the first is that there is the ethics of restraint. The second is the ethics of compassion. And the third is the ethics or inherent ethics. And the ethics of restraint is you have these rules, and you take on these rules either because, for some people, because the tradition tells you to, and your parents tell you to, and you should. This is what you should do. Or you take them on because you realize that they're useful to take on. There's a pragmatic reason to take them on. And this is what Buddhism tends to encourage. Rather than taking them on because it's tradition, you understand the pragmatic usefulness of precepts in your life. So you take on the precepts as a training or as a practice, rather than as something absolute that you have to do. So the Buddhist tendency is to assume or take on the precepts and work your life with them. So the way that when people take the precepts in Buddhism, lay precepts, the wording of taking them is, for the sake of my practice or for the sake of my training, I vow not to kill. You're not saying, you know, I'm not going to kill anymore, but it's conditional for the sake of my training, because you're taking it on because it's useful for the training of your heart, of your awareness, of your openness, of your relationship to the world. So it has this kind of pragmatic side to it. And in Buddhism, when a layperson takes the precepts that way, there isn't this kind of divine expectation that you're going to manage to keep them. But you do the best you can, and then periodically, regularly, you take them again, and you take them again. And traditionally in Buddhism, a layperson would go at least every 2 weeks, in the full moon, the new moon, to a temple, or find a monk or a nun, and would take the precepts over again. And sometimes in Asia, a layperson will go to a monastery in the full moon and the new moon. That's kind of like their Sundays or their Sabbath. And they would take the precepts at the beginning of the day, including for that day the precepts of celibacy, the one about not being involved in sexual misconduct. For that day is translated as being celibate. And for that one day, they'll be very careful with their ethical conduct. They won't kill an insect. They won't do anything. But it's done for that day. And it's considered to be very useful training to take it on that way. And you can do it for other reasons, the ethics of restraint, of holding yourself back. You can do it because it just makes good sense to do it. You'll have more friends. If people will respect you more. People will be delighted in you. I mean, sometimes it's really a delight to meet someone who you know you can trust because they're quite ethical. There's also another, in talking about the ethics of restraint, there's two other categories that might be useful to talk about, and that is the ethics of obligation versus the ethics of expression. And part of the reason, I think, why some people in the West, especially in the 60s and 70s, rebelled against the ethics of their culture was there was a feeling of obligation that you had to do it. And people didn't understand or didn't see or saw the problems with this kind of obligatory ethics. For one thing, many people noticed how hypocritical it was. That people would have this obligation, everybody assumed that they were doing in the back rooms, they were doing something else. It also tended to sometimes squash our natural integrity. There were aspects of our integrity which the so-called obligatory morality of our society didn't respect. Certain people's sexuality was squashed because they couldn't find any expression. And then it's a little bit related to that, but I think actually, but seemingly related, but quite different, is a lot of people react very strongly to obligatory ethics or the ethics of restraint because it's not in their self-interest. And we have a culture, I think, that focuses a lot on people's self-interest, on developing our egotistical desires. And there was a period of time, and I think there's always periods, it's always people like this, who then will experiment with saying, well, I'm going to give up the ethics of my parents, my elders, my community, and I'm just going to express myself because whatever I express myself is natural and it's free, and I'm not going to kind of live by any kind of artificial constraints. And people who try this for a while, and people who are honest, will notice that it doesn't work so well often. You just kind of do whatever you want to do. Because often our to express yourself is often gets confused with our egotism, our self-centeredness. And it's kind of very closely related to such questions as, what am I going to get from the situation? What can I get? And it's really, this notion of I deserve it. It's related to this question of rights versus responsibilities. And a lot of people in America's culture is struggling right now, I think, over this issue between obligation and expression, or rights and responsibilities. And I think the degree in which our culture is founded on capitalism and advertisement, we are one of the foundations, I think, is egotism in some ways, or self-centeredness. I think advertisement, in order for the commercial interest in our culture to work, it really works a lot better if people are self-centered and really want things for themselves. And the more you want for yourself, the more you'll buy. And there's many advertisements you hear these days where someone says, you deserve it, you know. Well, what is that reinforcing? You deserve it. Maybe, you know, it might be, sometimes it might be a good thing to tell someone, because sometimes people deny themselves too much. But what is our commercial culture teaching when it says that, you know, over and over again on television or on the radio, you deserve it. You deserve a trip to Hawaii. You deserve this. And then they send you all these applications for credit cards. You know. So those are some of the reasons, I think, why people have rebelled against the ethics of restraint or the ethics of obligation. Then there are other categories of ethics or ways of acting ethically. And one of them is the ethics of compassion. And that is where you have some sense of the people around you, the culture, the society, the world, the nature around you. And feeling a connection with that, you begin to acting in a different way than you would act if you're just doing it for your own sake. And you might still be restraining yourself, but the restraining yourself comes because of feeling some wholehearted, warm connection with someone else. You want to help someone, you want to alleviate suffering for someone, either because of the empathy. And I told this story here some years ago, it's probably worth saying again, of I used to live in the Lower Haight in San Francisco, just down a block away from the low-income projects. And I was in front of my house one day on the street, and this old beat-up car came down Haight Street and turned the corner onto Laguna, and kind of came to a screeching halt kind of in the middle of the intersection. And out of this back door came kind of flying or crawling more, kind of graspingly out, this woman came out hands first, screaming her head off for help, grasping onto the pavement, trying to pull herself out of the car. And these two big guys came out after her. And she said, you know, leave me alone, you know, help me. And they wanted to grab her and pull her back in the car. And here I was, you know, watching all this. So I immediately ran up to try to intervene, try to save or stop what was happening. And so as soon as I showed up, these guys kind of realized that they weren't alone and they felt a little bit inhibited to do what they were doing. But then there became this dance between me kind of saying, leave her alone, kind of yelling, leave her alone, and kind of stepping forward. And then one of these guys was huge. And he would take this step towards me. And then I'd take a step back and quiet down for a moment. And then he would go back to the woman and I'd go forward and leave her alone. And then so I went back and forth like a few times. And then this guy came walking up or running up, or I don't know how he was, a young, kind of somewhat athletic, he was bigger than me, but athletic guy. And he came up and said, he said kind of the same thing I said, you know, please leave her alone. He said it in a more calm presence maybe than I had. And he said, one of the guys who was grabbing the woman said, it's none of your business. Stay out of the way. You shouldn't get involved. And then this fellow said, I would hope that if someone was doing this to me, that you would intervene. And that softened the whole situation. And then the situation, I don't know how well it got resolved in the end, but the woman calmed down and was able to finally talk normally, and people could talk normally, and she got back in the car with the man and drove off. But what impressed me was what this guy said. And it's kind of, I think it's kind of the ethics of compassion. And there's a whole practice in Buddhism of imagining self as other. And what would it be like if you were in the other person's shoes? And how would it be that if you exchange self for other, how would you, what kind of ethics, how would you live your life then? So the ethics of compassion. And then there's a third category of ethics, and that's the ethics, what I call the inherent ethics. And this could also be understood to be an ethics of expression. But it's a very different kind of expression than what comes from your self-centeredness. The inherent ethics is, in this situation, we understand that the precepts are a description of reality. This is what reality is like. Maybe that's kind of a fancy way of saying something, but that a person who's awakened, a person who has awakened their heart, their sensitivity, their understanding, would naturally act aligned or in harmony with the precepts. They just wouldn't do it any other way. It's almost as if the precepts, maybe they don't even need to take the precepts anymore. The precepts are not an issue. But if you look at that person, they simply, it looks like as if they're living an ethical life. The understanding being in part that in order to break the precepts, to cross the line with the precepts, there has to be some kind of contraction of the mind or of the heart. There has to be some kind of unwholesome element, some extra overlay on our mind, our heart, and our body that allows us to act unethically. The ethics of restraint, one of the reasons why they're somewhat dangerous, even though they have their usefulness, is they can accentuate separation. And a lot of what happens, in order for someone to do something unethical, there virtually has to be, I would argue, a feeling of great separation. It's kind of like the other person's an object, or you're an object. You see yourself as a certain image, and you deserve something. And it's like them or us. You know, what can I get for myself in this situation? What is good for me? What is right for me? And that there's a kind of separation of self and other that's very harsh. And only with that harsh separation can unethical things happen. And the ethics of restraint sometimes, obligatory ethics, sometimes feed into that separation. And that in part is what's happening in this country now, I feel. There are people who really insist on their ethics. And the way in which they do that is really creating division. You know, we had the me generation in the 80s. And I don't know yet if we have a name for the 90s, do we? What? Yeah? But I was thinking that a good name, maybe what it's proving to be, is it's the them generation. Because it seems to have a lot to do with blame. It's them. But there's the precepts of the ethics of inherent ethics, which I think is what you come to when you meditate. I think sometimes you can feel what that's like when you even if you sit for 40 minutes sometimes and become quite settled on yourself and no longer have this tremendous, you're settled on yourself, but there isn't this focus on yourself, if you understand. It's very hard, I think, if you really settled on yourself or quieted down and released a lot of the constrictions in the heart and the mind. It's very hard to lie. It's very hard to break the precepts. And you might ask yourself, explore that sometime when you really feel intimate with yourself or really settled or open from your meditation practice. What would it feel like to do some of the things that you do when you're not settled in yourself? You know, have you ever lied? How often do you lie? White lies or whatever. How often do you, you know, whatever you do? I mean, I don't think any of us are really, probably most of us, I think most of us are probably very ethical. But I'm sure there's room for improvement. For all of us. And so you might, you know, at a time when you're really settled on yourself and you're really, you might take and see, you know, could you do the things you do some other times during your day? Could you do it from that state of mind, from that perspective? I think you can't. It doesn't compute. There was a guy who came to a retreat, a lawyer, and he came and asked at the retreat. He said, I'm really getting into Buddhism and practice. I really want to practice a lot and be, you know, really get into this religion. But as a lawyer in my job, I'm expected to lie. So please tell me how I can continue lying and do this practice. He was completely serious. That's what he said. Exactly. How can I continue lying? You can't. What?
Oh,
if you have to, it's much better to be mindfully. And maybe sometimes it's possible. Sometimes maybe it's the, you know, I lie sometimes. You know, it's what we call in our culture white lies. That's a big discussion in itself. You know, many of us are ready to justify that. When I first knew Walt Whitman, I used to think that he watched himself and did not allow his tongue to give expression to feelings of fretfulness and antipathy, complaint, or remonstrance. After long observation, I satisfied myself that such absence or unconsciousness was entirely real. His deep, clear, and earnest voice contributed to the charm of the simplest things he said. He never spoke deprecatingly of any nationality or class of men or time in the world's history or against any trades or occupations, not even against any animals, insects, plants, or inanimate things, nor any of the laws of nature, nor any of the results of the laws, such as illness, deformity, or death. He never complained or grumbled either at the weather, pain, illness, or anything else. He never in conversation used language that could be considered indelicate. He never spoke in anger, never exhibited fear, and I do not believe he ever felt it. So what do you think of a person like that? It could be, but there is an element of inherent ethics. And I think that some people either from having worked on themselves so much or because of who knows why, seem extremely, I don't like using the word, but extremely pure. And you know, all of us are in some, there's a spectrum. And you expect to find, you know, just because of probability, you expect to find some people on one end of the spectrum and some on the other. And the Buddhist tradition, in its mythology, I would say, they would say that Walt Whitman, probably attained at least the first stage of enlightenment in a former lifetime. And so he was living, kind of, so a lot of stuff was already taken care of when he was born. So there are, the recognition there are such people, and the Buddhism has these theories to explain how that could be. But I think it comes bit by bit from the practice. And I think it's something we can each feel ourselves. And I felt that, you know, especially like my first long Vipassana retreat. This is interesting. My first long Vipassana retreat in Thailand, before I went, I'd met this Japanese woman. And I kind of fallen, kind of, not exactly in love with her, but I was very sexually attracted to her. And so I spent a lot of time, I was flying to Thailand, and I was first there. I was thinking, well, as soon as I get back, I'm going to look her up for you know what. And then I sat there in the retreat for many weeks, and at some point I noticed that I simply didn't have that kind of lust or desire for her. I still was interested in friendship with her, but that element was missing, was gone. And I recognized that the practice had settled me to a place of much greater integrity or contentness or peace or settledness, and that my sexual desires for this woman arose for me, in that situation, arose out of a feeling of lack of contentment or restlessness in my life. And I recognized, you know, how powerful the practice was. And so, you know, that retreat ended, and then other things came back. You know, well, that was a beginning. From inherent, I think what happens when you sit, when you meditate, or open yourself up in the world of mindfulness, is the harsh separation between you and the situation begins softening. And as it does that, there's a different kind of expressive ethics that can come out. Because an expressive ethics is not simply self-centered, it's not egotistical, but comes out of the whole situation that you're in. And it's as if you become a medium for the situation. And you're part of the situation, but you're not ignoring yourself. And there's understanding in Buddhism that that form of expressive ethics is trustable, is safe. So we're back in expressive ethics again, but from a very different place than maybe, you know, the 60s was, or some people are sometimes. And so there's an emphasis in Buddhism on situational-dependent ethics. But the situation is not, you know, you're part of the situation in the sense that you're incorporating it or processing it through your open-mindedness, through your open-heartedness, through your spaciousness, through your settledness, or whatever the word is that describes what happens when we practice. And then an interesting thing happens. If you begin to have some sense of this possibility, and you feel like what a beautiful thing it is. And I felt like in that first retreat, when I kind of my restless sexual cravings kind of settled, and I saw how beautiful that was, to have the alternative, how beautiful and precious it was, that then you have a new appreciation for the ethics of restraint. And then it's possible to take on the ethics of restraint from a very different perspective. That you understand, you see how clearly it supports your deepening and settling on yourself in your deeper nature of who you are. And so the precepts become something you love and become a joy rather than an obligation. And you realize you kind of need, the precepts are a protection. They help you. They're a help. They're an aid. And one way that they're an aid is that rather than being the precepts being a precepts of obligation, this is what you have to do. In part, what the precepts are, is they're a line that you've drawn. When you have that line, you can notice when you step over the line. So it becomes a cue. The precepts become a cue or a suggestion. And the suggestion is, the cue is, you should pay attention now. Something's going on now that requires your attention. So rather than saying, "Oh, I'm bad," you say, "Oh, this is interesting. Now I got to find out what's going on." So rather, and it's a suggestion that maybe you've left. You're no longer centered on your deep nature, on your deeper sense of self. And rather than beating yourself up, you try to understand the situation as best you can, and understand how you've departed from that natural sense of integrity. And that's a lot different, understanding the precepts. So the precepts become very important, but as a finger pointing to something that you've learned to value. Yes?
You said these precepts are sort of situational, and I'm wondering if another night we could talk about what we eat.
In Buddhism we say, you are what you think. Maybe. I'll think about it.
I don't want to dwell too long on Walt Whitman, but the piece you read about him said that whoever wrote it thought that maybe Whitman didn't even think or feel these things, these feelings. But he wrote all these poems. And makes it hard to understand how he could have written those poems without the feelings that were in them.
Oh, he wasn't.
Or am I misinterpreting?
Oh, he didn't. It wasn't that he was passionless. It wasn't that he had no feelings and emotions. I think he had deep feelings and emotions, but he didn't have anger or fear.
He was completely open.
Very lofty and idealized in nature.
I'm going to have to read his poems again, I guess.
Yes, I don't know.
But I had this impression that he wrote of some deep longings about things, and that's not exactly fear or anger, but it's getting into some pretty heavy emotional stuff, too.
Yeah, I don't know his poetry.
I don't know it very well either.
I celebrate myself.
Yeah.
I know that's that poem.
But getting to what the core of what you're saying is that you want to focus more on the ethics of the expression rather than on the ethics of what feelings come up. Because feelings come up kind of spontaneously, but we have a little gate about what we express if we're aware.
Yeah. Well, I think that what we're trying to do is become more aware of what's happening, be aware of the movements of the mind, movements of the heart. And the more aware you become, then I think the more you have some choice in how we live our life and how we... So I think that Dick and I should have this conversation after we finish. Because we're running late. So thank you all.